You're listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio. I'm Casey Gilman. The College Connection is a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. This forum provides an opportunity for listeners to engage with the researchers, intellectuals, poets, and authors active within our academic communities. Franklin Otto, born in 1939 in Honolulu, Hawaii, was the founding director of the Smithsonian's Asian Pacific American Program, interim chief of the Asian Division at the Library of Congress, and was one of the pioneers of the field of Asian American studies. He's currently the John J. McCloy Visiting Professor of American Institutions and International Diplomacy at Amherst College. Otto's talk, entitled Concentration Camps, American Style, Japanese Americans and World War II, was recorded on November 1, 2016, in Herder Hall at UMass Amherst. The talk was part of the UMass Amherst History Department's Feinberg Family Distinguished Lecture Series, The U.S. in the Age of Mass Incarceration. The airing of Otto's talk marks a day of remembrance for Japanese Americans, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt authorized the deportation and incarceration of Japanese Americans with Executive Order 9066 on February 19th.
I want to start by following up with Vera's references to Asian American studies. When we started the field in 1968-1969, it was very difficult to envision having so many colleagues here to support one. This was a real threat for the academy. So if this is any indication of the degree to which we've made some inroads, I'm delighted. And I think this is a really great thing. One of the reasons I'm happy to be here for this particular series is mass incarceration is really an interesting and important part of what we're facing in life and in the United States today. The topic I'm speaking about, Japanese Americans and mass incarceration, is one of these examples. And if there are any of you who are interested in going on to law school, you will note that there were four major cases that went before the United States Supreme Court in 1943-44. And they're actually very important cases in terms of looking at national security and the interests of individual or group rights and the conflicts that come along when there are threats to, the perceived threats to American society. And we can at least say that, like so many critical events in history, that the impact and significance of those events are not gone, they're not past. So phrases like the presence of the past or the living legacies of history are very much with us. Let me just start by, for how many of you have, let me just ask this, how many of you are acquainted with what I would call the bare facts of Japanese American incarceration? Most of you, okay, good. Then I can cut this part short. So from on December 7th, 1941, the Japanese Imperial Navy bombs Pearl Harbor, the Philippines. It's already occupied parts of Asia. For a brief period of about 2 months, the media is actually fairly responsible about reminding the American public that we should not be too precipitous about trying to place blame on the people of Japanese descent in the United States. After that, all hell breaks loose. And there are all kinds of reasons that scholars allege. We know there's economic motivation to get rid of Japanese American competitors. There are very few of them, less than 1% of the state of California, for example, but they're pretty significant in agriculture and fishing, particularly. So that some of the truck crops are dominated by Japanese immigrant farmers. The Japanese have the notoriety maybe of having pioneered the term that many of us are now familiar with Asian, at least Asian Americans. The first generation are called Issei, which in the Japanese language is, means first generation. And the second generation are Nisei, second generation, and third generation are Sansei, or three generations. I'm Sansei. My parents were, my mom was born in Colorado, my dad in Hawaii. They were both taken to Japan for the first time, reared there, so they grew up bilingual and bicultural. Returned to Hawaii, met, married, and had me and three other kids as well. So I was born in 1939. So I lived through World War II. If I had been in California or Oregon or Wisconsin or the southern tip of Arizona, I would have been considered at age two a dangerous threat to national security, and been removed, forcibly removed from my home along with my parents and siblings into one of the assembly centers and then concentration camps. And I wanna talk a little bit about the terminology, because I suspect that there are at least some of you who are not comfortable with the term concentration camps as applied to the American institution. And my wife certainly wasn't. She happens to be Jewish, and her friends who are also Jewish, we had some very heated discussions, I should say. Actually, it's kind of a miracle that we're still married, but that's not the only reason. But if you go back to, and I guess the term is euphemism, which is, I guess the definition is a mild word or expression substituted for one considered blunt and embarrassing. One of a really interesting characters from the previous millennium was the author William Sapphire, who wrote, "To some degree, euphemism is a strategic misrepresentation." So I want to talk about some of the words that we use, that were used before by both the people who were removed and forcibly relocated, 120,000 people. And I know some of you here have done a lot of work with Native American studies. So there's some intersections here that are really interesting. The Trail of Tears involved, to the best of my understanding, about 40,000 people. It was harsh, devastating, and terrible. But the Japanese American forced relocation involved several times more people. So the first, when the United States government decided it needed to justify what it was doing, I'm talking about now about 42 through 45, it used the term to evacuate. So this was an evacuation. Now for most of us, evacuation means removing people from danger. Merriam-Webster Dictionary says the process of temporarily moving people away from an immediate and real danger, such as a fire, flood, shootout, or bomb threat. Well, this was clearly not the case. They were not evacuated to protect them from a disastrous environment. In fact, these people were not really being helped, and they were being put into camps where there was barbed wire, guard towers with firearms being appointed in. Internment is a term that I often use for the process that was that describes the incarceration of Japanese Americans. But internment has a particular legal implication of enemy aliens being incarcerated. And because of the 120,000 people, two-thirds of whom were born in the United States, this is not quite right either. There were, in fact, Issei Japanese immigrants who were interned, and that's an absolutely proper terminology. And there were a few thousand Japanese Issei men who were removed from their homes, some of them on the day of the attack, on December 7, 1941. And the reason they were removed so quickly and so efficiently was the fact that the FBI had lists of people who were considered dangerous. And dangerous, in the eyes of American government officials at the time, because we didn't know exactly who might be willing or able to assist potential Japanese invaders, who if there were such an invasion force on the American shores, the closest approximation they had was proximity to Japanese culture. So people who were Japanese language teachers, principals, teachers of martial arts, people who were in Japanese chambers of commerce, folks who had been regularly corresponding with Japanese institutions in Japan, those were the people, or who had particular proximity to Japanese cultural arts, kabuki, movies, theater, the scholarly world, so on. Those were the people who were picked up on December 7th. But let me just say one last thing about terminology before I want to move on soon to a very quick PowerPoint to give you a sense of the photographs of some of the events that took place. In case you are not familiar with the images, I thought that would be a useful way to take us through some of the steps. And then I want to not take up so much time with that, and then end with a few comments, and then open it up to the audience, because I think you have probably a great deal to say, and a number of questions that you might want to ask. There is something, an institution called the Japanese American National Museum in the city of Los Angeles. It was the first large major ethnic-specific museum in the country, I think, for its time and space. So, and it began in conceptually in the 1970s and 80s. In 1994, the Japanese American National Museum, JANM, in Los Angeles, curated a new exhibition. And they called it America's Concentration Camps, Remembering the Japanese American Experience. Now this exhibit, the leadership of JANM negotiated with Ellis Island Immigration Museum to bring it to New York City in 1998-1999. But in preparing to move the exhibition from LA to Ellis Island, there arose a serious controversy over the term concentration camp. Remember I said New York City. So obviously a large Jewish population lives there, and people were uncomfortable with that terminology. So a number of Holocaust survivors and relatives expressed sensitivity towards public confusion over what we now tend to think of as death camps, rather than of concentration camps being a euphemism for some of the camps that were implemented in Nazi Germany. So a meeting of representatives from JANM and seven American Jewish organizations resulted in a text which I'll read to you that was placed at the beginning of the exhibit that eventually opened. Although the Park Service being a federal agency, was sensitive to concerns about any particular constituency, because the Congress tends to react with alarm and alacrity if there is a sizable group with a fair amount of political clout. So the initial response from the Park Service was to disallow the exhibit unless it changed its name. So there was a meeting, a significant meeting between the leaders of JANM and the seven Jewish American constituency groups. And they hashed out the technical definitions of the term, the implications of the term, and towards the end of the meeting, Senator Daniel Inouye walked in. Senator Inouye, for those of you who are not familiar, was for a time, he died in 2012, but he was a senator from my home state, Hawaii, and he was, because the Senate runs on seniority, he was an extremely powerful person. For one thing, he brought a lot of money back to the islands. And at one point in time, he was third in line for the presidency after the vice president, the Speaker of the House, and he was a Senate pro tempore, President pro tempore. So he was an extremely important person. He also was a veteran of World War II, fought with the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which was, for its size and length of service, the most highly decorated combat unit in American history. And so he was a man. He also, at the end of World War II, I'm told, had almost converted to Judaism after he had considered working with Native American indigenous peoples. So he was, by some at least, beloved in Hawaii by Native Hawaiians because he was particularly sensitive to their needs. So I give you this background to tell you that he walks into this meeting, which was very contentious and very heated, and then he quieted the crowd because the Jewish leaders all knew who he was because he's supported Israel and he supported American Jewish causes, and they knew him intimately. And he was also on the board of governors of the Japanese American National Museum. And he rose to support JANM and to explain that he supported the use of the term concentration camps, and to explain that he thought this was an appropriate terminology for this particular experience. And then he said, you all, I can't replicate his voice, which was very deep and sonorous, but he said, you all will have to excuse me. I have to leave now. So he has his right sleeve empty and he's walking towards the door and he says, I have to get back to the Senate. There's a very important bill upon which we need to vote in the Senate, and it concerns support for Israel. So needless to say, the group eventually agreed to collaborate, and so at the beginning of the exhibition, there was this sort of a label that was kind of a disclaimer, but also something that explained to the visiting public why they should not be upset. And I'll quote here. A concentration camp is a place where people are imprisoned, not because of any crimes they committed, but simply because of who they are. Although many groups have been singled out for such persecution throughout history, the term concentration camps was first used at the turn of the century in the Spanish-American and Boer Wars. The Boer Wars, you may remember, with the British in South Africa and Dutch in South Africa. During World War II, America's concentration camps were clearly distinguishable from Nazi Germany's. Nazi camps were places of torture, barbarous medical experiments, and summary executions. Some were extermination centers with gas chambers. 6 million Jews and many others, including gypsies, Poles, homosexuals, and political dissidents, were slaughtered in the Holocaust. In recent years, concentration camps have existed in the former student union. I'm sorry, that was not intended. In the former Soviet Union. Maybe it was better. The former Soviet Union, Cambodia, and Bosnia. Despite the difference, all had one thing in common. The people in power removed a minority group from the general population, and the rest of society let it happen. Close quotes. And what I'll end before the PowerPoint with one last reference to Norman Thomas. How many of you here know who he was? Not very many, huh? Norman Thomas was, I think in 1902, a very early graduate of Princeton University, and very quickly became, which was very strange for that university, to have produced a leader of the Socialist Party in the United States. And so he was a perennial nominee from the Socialist Party for President of the United States. So he was running for the presidency many, many times. He was one of the very few national leaders to protest the executive order issued by President Franklin Roosevelt on February 19th, 1942, the executive order which cleared the way for Public Law 103, which then released the military to begin establishing sites, places where people were going to be forcibly removed from their homes and businesses into assembly centers and then into concentration camps. So, but what he said after World War II, when, as I said, he was one of the very few people who protested the treatment of Japanese Americans. He said, quote, "In an experience of nearly three decades, I have never found it harder to arouse the American public on any important issue than this." So today we have a really different kind of a setting where it's a lot more reasonable to find people who are alarmed. Say when somebody says we should lock up all the Muslims, or we should keep these people off our shores, or we should stop them from implementing Sharia law. Those things are hopefully not as easily communicated to the American public as they once were. Now, so let me go to the PowerPoint at this point and go through this fairly quickly so you get a sense of some of the images. So Japanese immigration begins in large scale after the 1880s. There's a group that comes in 1868, but after the 1880s, not by coincidence probably, the 1882 Act by Congress, which excludes the Chinese from becoming immigrants or becoming naturalized citizens. The first time in American history when that happens, it happens to the Chinese by designating a particular ethnic nationality or race from entering the country or becoming naturalized citizens. So the Japanese are welcomed at first. So this is a woven suitcase, a passport, immigration document. Bainbridge Island was interesting partly because off of Seattle, in Washington State, partly because it had a newspaper editor whose name I now forget, a white editor who was very courageous and who kept publishing his paper, insisting that this was a bad mistake and a terrible travesty to incarcerate or forcibly relocate Japanese Americans. And he was much honored by the community after that. So here's the picture on your right is a newly married couple, and we know for sure this is in Hawaii with the plantations, and the bags behind them are bags, 100-pound bags of rice, which are often given as wedding presents. So by 1900, after the original immigrants had begun to enter Hawaii in 1886, there were about 61,000 people living in Hawaii. Close to 30% of the population by then. So these are sugar workers, sugarcane mill. And on the continent, on the mainland, a smaller group became largely migrant farmers, small farmers or migrant workers, carrying their blankets and going from farm to farm or from fishing village to fishing village. And they, some of them became quite productive and entrepreneurial. So a number of them were quite successful in creating their own brands of fruits and vegetables. By the early 1900s, there was a considerable amount of anti-Japanese sentiment that arose in the United States. So here is a political cartoon. If you go back to the cartoons from this era, you will see many examples of cartoons like this. The Statue of Liberty, Uncle Sam. No, it just means liberty for Yankees. So as I say, in 1941, war is declared. The racial conflict heats up very quickly. Executive Order 9066. By the way, next February 19th will be the 75th anniversary of the commemoration of Executive Order 9066. So stay tuned. I see my friend, my colleague, Cien Le here. Maybe you'll be doing something here. I'm sure we'll be doing something on the Amherst College campus as well. One of the interesting things, you all are interested in language, I'm sure, so that the Executive Order 9066 does not mention Japanese Americans by name. So I think it's interesting enough, there's a Supreme Court case brought by a Chinese immigrant in the 1890s, which went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And what it challenged was the San Francisco ordinance that was prima facie neutral, did not mention the Chinese by name, but in the implementation of the act, which controlled, which limited the cubic airspace for Chinese laundries. No, I think I have that wrong. I think it's the creating wooden structures for Chinese laundries, because a lot of the Chinese had gone into laundries and said, and the law said, laundries which are built of wood are illegal because they're susceptible to fire. But it was only implemented against the Chinese. And it was implemented against the Chinese because the city fathers understood that it was the Chinese who had wooden laundries. Non-Chinese laundries, the few that there were, used non-wooden structures. So the Supreme Court, in striking down that ordinance, said it is unconstitutional to enact legislation which on its face is neutral, but which then is easily implemented in a discriminatory fashion. So if you think today about voting laws and voter ID laws, you can see that sometimes history just doesn't go away. Okay, so this one, no mention of the Japanese Americans, but that's who it was obviously targeted at, and that's who the army moved against, and that's who became the victims of this process. So the movement, this forced relocation of Japanese Americans, impacted so many parts of the American Constitution that when the Smithsonian Institution, the National Museum of American History, opened its exhibit called A More Perfect Union in 1987, it started with a rolling video of commentators talking about this issue, a large-scale guard tower with sentries on there, with armed sentries, and then a wall that had the Articles of the Constitution screened on the wall with the numbers of the constitutional elements that had been transgressed by virtue of this. It was all. I mean, it was an incredible kind of thing. So all 14 amendments, I think, at the time were listed. Now, this is Dr. Seuss, who later recanted, by the way, his anti-Japanese sentiment. But I don't know, some of us grew up on Dr. Seuss, so it was quite a shock to discover that he, among other people, had perpetrated anti-Japanese sentiments. So these orders were generally put up in 108 different neighborhoods, stretching from Washington down to the southern tip of Oregon. And so if you can sort of imagine having these posters go up with directions for people of any percentage, this is a one-drop rule, any background of a Japanese heritage at all, that you needed to report to, let's say, the student union or Herder Hall by 10 days or 12 days, 2 weeks maximum. Get rid of your property, get rid of your pets. Terrible stories of people killing their pets because they knew that they would not be able to be salvaged. So anyway, and then go to these places where they were then picked up by buses, transported to train stations, and then ordered to pull the window shades down, and then asked to, and then taken, they knew not where. For what? They knew not. For how long? They knew not. So they could carry only what, they could carry two suitcases and that was it. So as I said, there were FBI searches. The only people who actually got a measure of interrogation and justice in this were the early Issei who were picked up, interestingly enough. The mass incarceration, which included all Japanese Americans born here who were citizens, were instances in which there was not a single trial. No one was charged with anything. No one obviously was indicted. No one was convicted. And they were all put away, usually for 3 years, but sometimes for four, sometimes for less. And the hostility was very interesting. So it's kind of interesting to see in our history how when there is anti-Asian hostility directed at a particular group, the other group becomes happens to become favored, maybe a moral minority. So when the war started, and China was an ally, the Exclusion Act that I mentioned from 1882, directed at the Chinese, was repealed in 1943. So I think this is a Time magazine. I forget Time or Life. And so they were depicted. So the Jap naval officers were described as having longer torsos, shorter legs, shorter squat, as opposed to Chinese officers. These are actual images. but when to be fair, when sentiments ran against the Chinese, the Japanese community tended to do similar things. So this is the moving out. The image on your left, the young girl is still alive. This is Bainbridge Island, I think, and is an older woman now. So here are some scenes of the removal. Topaz, welcome to Topaz City. Topaz is, if we have time later, I'll tell you about this. Topaz is one of the camps, the concentration camps, the relocation centers, the 10 major camps that were created by the government, just 16 miles north of Delta, Utah. Anybody here from Utah? Yay! There you go. There is somebody's here. You know Delta? Have you been to Delta? Have you been to Delta? You have? Oh, wow. So anyway, I've been to this place and I actually toured the site of Topaz. In many cases, a number of these places in Hard Mountain, Wyoming, Topaz, Utah, Arkansas, Arizona, they became the second or third largest cities in those particular states because they each housed maybe 8,000 to 10,000 Japanese Americans. But we had, some of my students will remember Kiko. We had a student in the seminar on Japanese Americans in World War II in spring. So she went back home after graduation, took her mom, whose family was in Topaz, and arranged for a tour by the museum director. And the museum director was nice enough to pull out a sheet that described where all of the barracks were and could find the exact barrack where her mom's family had been incarcerated. So it was really quite an extraordinary event in her life. This is Manzanar. Of course, people were put to work there. There's a lot of archaeological work being done, both in Chinese railroad sites and Japanese American camps. Community activities. There's a book called Baseball Saved Our Lives about baseball being played in the camps. Children, arts and culture, a lot of art and culture taking place. A lot of people being dislocated from their jobs and their homes, and with nothing to do, found work and space to do what they needed to. The master narrative for this event emphasizes the degree to which the Japanese American community responded to these horrendous acts by with loyalty to the United States. This is not altogether true. And I think we're beginning to find out people were resisted the acts of loyalty because they were angry at what had happened to them. And many of them who were drafted became draft resistors. The largest draft resistance trial in American history took place in Wyoming, where 169 second-generation Japanese Americans who were drafted in 1944 said, you know what? I think you're not supposed to draft people who are incarcerated like this anyway. But if you do, we're not going to fight until you release our parents from this prison. So they were convicted and sent to federal prison. And that's an interesting story in itself. But the main narrative subsequent to the war was of people like this who served with honor and dignity, like Danny Noyer. And lots of Purple Hearts, 21 medals of honor went to this group. An amazing group. If you know anything about military history and about how rarely medals of honor are awarded for bravery in combat, you would know. So this is a post-war period. Maybe we can talk a little bit later about redress and the successful drive to be compensated. This is the apology signed for the American Promise by Gerald Ford. And this is a really interesting slide about a destruction of original relocation report. During when the government responded to two of the Supreme Court cases in 1943. They were decided in 44. FDR evidently managed to avoid having the cases come to the court until he was elected in November of 1944, because he didn't want the public to confront the issue of Japanese American concentration camps while the election was going on. So he was successfully elected to his fourth term and died soon thereafter. But in that process, the government lied. The executive department actually lied to the Supreme Court, developed a set of documents that contradicted what they knew to be the truth. And this basically was whether there was any military necessity to remove these people and put them into camps. But basically, we knew that this was not the case, and we did it anyway. So one of the things that happened was, as a result, was that the redress movement gained a lot of strength. And in 1988, August 10th, that's Ronald Reagan signing the redress bill, which provided for an official apology to 88,000 Japanese Americans who were still alive on that date, on August 10th, and provided for payments of $20,000 each. So people are still here. That's Senator Inouye receiving his Medal of Honor from President Clinton. So that's the story there. So I want to just say a couple of things, and then we'll open it up to questions. At the Hampshire Mall on December 13th, 7:30, there will be a video aired shown of a musical with George Takei. So some of you may be interested in just because of George Takei. I understand. Either because you're LGBTQ or because you Star Trek fans, but it doesn't matter. It's a pretty interesting musical. So if you have a chance, take a look. I want to mention that if you want information further on this event and series, check out densho.org, densho.org, which has a website which has an extraordinary amount of information, books, movies, articles, A to Z encyclopedic stuff. So it's quite a treasure trove of information. Thank you.
That was Professor Franklin Odo speaking on November 1st, 2016, in Herder Hall at UMass Amherst. Next week, we'll hear from Dennis Childs, Associate Professor of African American Literature and an affiliate faculty member of the Department of Ethnic Studies and Critical Gender Studies at the University of California, San Diego. His talk, U.S. Neo-Slavery, A History of the Prison Industrial Present, was recorded on October 13th, 2016, in the Goodell Hall at UMass Amherst.
Slavery was, as Angela Davis notes, not only a system of surplus value expropriation of the labor of captives, but it was also a system, as she calls it, a system of incarceration. She talks about the transition from chattel slavery to prison slavery being one of a transition from the prison of slavery to the slavery of prison. Why, when you look at pre-1865 regimes of incarceration in the South, was the numbers for Africans infinitesimally small? Because they were already imprisoned on the plantation. That's the reason. And that's why, after 1865, they continued to be imprisoned on the plantation. Most of the southern prisons, I'll get into this later, are converted slave plantations. And much of what has been converted is the name. Angola in Louisiana used to be a slave plantation. It would say that, Angola slave plantation, or Angola plantation. Romantically, maybe they called it like some kind of Gone with the Wind name. Now it's called LSP, Louisiana State Penitentiary. And people whose ancestors slaved in plantation fields there going back to its beginning are slaving in those same fields right now as we sit here. But it's not about the big bad South. Because for me, spaces like Angola and spaces like this in Georgia in the 1930s, this is a picture from John Spivak's book on a muckraking journalist account of his tour of chain gangs in the South in the 1930s. And what was found there and what you'll find in reading Angela Davis's work, Alex Lichtenstein, David Oshinsky, Douglas Blackman, and so many more, is that this is not a story of a return to pre-modernity or the anachronistic bad South. That modernity, the move of the South into the industrializing image of the North, the supposedly racially innocent North, was based on neo-slave labor and neo-enslavement in general, not just labor. And that is a crucial point, is that slavery is not pre-modern. Slavery is foundational and modern. It is the stuff that US and European modernity is made of, along with colonialism. So somehow Foucault was able to write Discipline and Punish and not recognize the moving prison from the chain gangs in Georgia from the 1930s, even later than this. Why was it a mobile prison stacking people on top of each other by the threes, as you see here, two rows, in this hot, sweltering place with a hole cut in the middle of it as they're chained together so that they could urinate and defecate? Why was it on wheels? Because they were building the entire infrastructure of the South, including highways and railroads. So they had to be mobile to do that work. All of the roads surrounding Atlanta, Georgia, were built by prison slave labor. It's interesting that this can be so fundamental that U.S. Steel is implicated through Tennessee Coal and Iron, its subsidiary in the South. But most people, how many of you read about neo-slavery in high school? Look around, everyone. So there's an investment in the mythology of progress. Malcolm X famously said, "You can't stick a knife in a person's back 12 inches and pull it back 6 and call it progress." They won't even admit that the knife is there. And in this situation, the most galling aspect of what I'm introducing here, and I promise I'll read a little bit, but I have a lot to say before I do. The most galling aspect of white supremacist, racial capitalist, misogynist practice, there's a lot of terms, I'm in my bell hooks kind of mode, but there's meaning. It's not just jargon. The most galling aspect of this practice, I just came from San Diego where a refugee from Uganda, Alfred Alongo, escaped with his family from a war-torn environment only to be murdered in front of his sister by an officer of the law, in front of his sister who called for help because he was having a mental episode, because he had just lost a loved one to premature death. Broad daylight, in front of her, as she's telling them, "Do not kill my brother." And he is then blamed for it. So the most galling aspect is not only is this procession continuing, that necklace continuing to add beads, that old wine continually poured, but then the agent of that violence levies culpability against the object of that violence. So not only are you victimized, but then your victimhood is transmuted into criminality. What did you do? What did you steal? What was your record? Where were your hands? Why didn't you get up? Why didn't you get out? Why were you breathing? So Foucault's model of history did not take it into account the modern aspect of chattel slavery, not as an anachronism, not as a pre-capitalist mode of production, but as, again, the very scaffolding upon which carceral modernity is based. If you look at the actual physical structures over time, the past is not past. It's an open wound that continues to open with every breath. $70 billion a year in this modern version of a long prison industrial complex, going back to that ship pulling up to Jamestown. $70 billion of public monies to lock up a major portion of the public. I said 70% people of color, 99.9% poor. One out of three black boys born today will do time in a cage if things go at the rate they are. An 800% increase in the incarceration of black women since 1980. From 1852 to 1980, 9 prisons built in California. Anybody good at math? How many years is that? My undergrad's in the house. 1852 to 1980, there were 9 prisons built in what is now the prison capital of the world. 128, is it? Years? From 1980 to 2005, 22 were built. There are more prisoners in California now than there were in the entire country in 1960. Did people start drinking criminal Kool-Aid in 1980? Where is that $70 billion a year going? And it's not just a matter of the profitability, it's a matter of controlling a population that was in mass uprise when Nixon made that call for law and order. Does that ring a bell? I seem to recall somebody running for some office using that same phrase recently, who will not be named. My son is very much into Harry Potter, so. So a cargoing of human beings that are branded as natural born criminals, it's not about what you did, it's about who you are. What Sylvia Winter describes as the ontological subordination of people of African descent, which means in the very being, there's a transmutation through law, through discourse, through media, of our very being into something that is always justified homicide, always already. Or as Ruth Wilson Gilmore says, always subject to premature death. Defining racism materially at the level of the body, not at the level of whether somebody was nice to me today only, but at the level of, will I make it to the end of this day? Will I actually survive? And that not being hyperbole. Now we have cameras to give us indication of something that many of us have always known and had to know in order to think about the possibility of surviving. If that makes some of you feel uncomfortable, imagine living that experience. One theorist said, because here we see, you know, I gave a lecture at California State University, Fullerton, the other day, and I mentioned, you know, a part of the prison industrial complex is about profit. So you have companies like Victoria's Secret, for instance, having prisoners doing telemarketing. The entire California State University system, all the furniture that you would be sitting on if you were there right now was made by prison slave labor. So we know that story. But this picture gives you an indication of something else. And then there's also the unproductive labor, in quotes, of the prison as a plant. Just like the original plantation, the prison as plantation, there's not an element of it that does not require or demand labor by prisoners. Your good conduct is dictated by whether you comply to doing all of the labor that makes the plantation go. So those are important, but it's not just about labor. It's also about what Gilmore and other scholars call human warehousing, or what Mumia Abu-Jamal calls the biggest public housing project in US history. What do you do with a population that whose labor is no longer needed, who did the grunt work of the Industrial Revolution, and who now, who would formerly have worked at a Chrysler plant in Flint or in Detroit, but now you've outsourced all of those jobs where you could pay slave wages in the global South. What do you do with that population? Thomas Jefferson's idea of what do you do with that population after they're no longer needed is to get rid of them. Cryptically, he said that. Cryptically. Maybe we can talk about this as a process of forced relocation and getting rid of and human warehousing. And the theorist Stephen Donziger says, companies that service the criminal justice system need sufficient quantities of raw materials to guarantee long-term growth. In the criminal justice field, the raw material is prisoners, and it will do whatever it needs to do to guarantee a steady supply. So it's not the labor of the prisoner per se, but the prisoner's body as the nexus of profitability and power. You are the commodity, so you don't necessarily have to produce any, at least for those agents that are publicly trading on it. And not just private prisons. Get rid of that from your mind. Because going back to the original private prisons, that being the plantations, public interest, public law, state practice was always involved from the very beginning. So maybe I'll read a little bit. While Foucault barely makes mention of slavery in his compelling history of the modern prison, the writings, soundings, and survival practices of Black prisoners define chattel slavery as primordial and tenaciously undead, a tenaciously undead regime of Euro-American modernity as the legal, political, architectural, and cultural linchpin of racial capitalist misogynist imprisonment in the United States as it has morphed from the slave ship holds and barracoons of the Middle Passage to the portable boxcar cages of early Jim Crow apartheid, to the coffin-simulating boxcar cells of today's prison industrial complex. Indeed, when read as one overarching, cross-fertilizing, and temporally unfixed network of terror, the U.S. system of mass imprisonment that began well before the term prison industrial complex was ever uttered is what Peter Tosh might call a liberal white supremacist system. That has produced an as yet uncalculated number of premature dead. Notwithstanding the tendency within the U.S. juridical, legislative, and penal law to disavow the chattel origins of modern incarceration, there have been key moments in which postbellum liberal legal discourse has offered bold-faced articulation of the state's enslaving and murderous bearing towards criminally and racially stigmatized subjects. In Ruffin versus Commonwealth, Justice J. Christian of the Supreme Court of Virginia supplies just this sort of open declaration of the law's re-chattelizing functionality vis-a-vis former slaves in his ostensibly colorblind construction of the civilly dead non-position of the criminally branded felon. Quote, he has, as a consequence of his crime, not only forfeited his liberty, but all his personal rights except those which the law in its humanity accords to him. He is, for the time being, a slave of the state. He is civilité mortis, civilly dead, and his estate, if he has any, is administered like that of a dead man. End quote.
You've been listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio, a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. You can find more College Connection online at nepr.net or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. For New England Public Radio, I'm Casey Gilman.